Good evening, everybody. This is a joint special committee on healthcare transformation, May 4th, and I'd like to welcome everyone here. I'd like to thank you, and thank your committee, and I apologize for starting the committee a little late. The process that we have tonight is basically, it's extremely important for the committee to go through the Dash 3 amendments. It's definitely not going to be the final product at all, because we have found some changes that some of us want, but we really want to discuss the entire amendment with the committee to see where they're coming from, as well as some other things that we may want to add or take out. That's very important to us. And then hopefully we'll take about an hour for that, and then the rest of the time will be for public hearing. And since there's so many that have signed up to testify, I really want the testimony to be strictly on the Dash 3 amendments. We don't need any other information about your organization or what you do or what you do well. We really only have next week and the following week, and then we're done. And so we go through the amendments now. We'll be making some changes, going over those changes without any more input, and then be passing it out in 2 weeks, 2 weeks from tonight. Hopefully, if we can get a majority of votes here. All right, so I said about 3 minutes, and we only want you to address the Dash 3 amendments, and then written comments, I guess we'll wait to decide this, but I think we're doing it. Yeah. Written comments are to be to Rick by Thursday, 5 p.m. Any comments that come in after that, we really don't have time to consider. So 5 o'clock tomorrow night, send your concepts to Rick, and we will then probably assemble those in a format that we then will discuss on Wednesdays, and hopefully we'll actually have another Dash 4 or 5 amendments by next Wednesday night. All right. With that,
can I make a quick comment?
Mr. Administrator.
Thank you, Chair. You do have distributed to you at the dais, and we put on our website an engrossed version of House Bill 3650 with the Dash 3 amendments engrossed in. In our rush to get it through, I just wanted to point out there was a slight error. If you go to page 40, the very last page of the hand engrossed version, on line 4, you should place brackets around 414741. That was taken out.
Just put brackets on that.
Say again, will you?
On line 4, just put brackets around 414741. That was removed. And then on line 5, put brackets around that whole line. And line 6, put brackets around that whole line. Those both were removed in the Dash 3. We just didn't catch that in the engrossment.
Great.
And just a minor, on line 21, there is just a numbering error halfway through where it says section 21, on line 20, on page 21, that should say section 22 in the...
Which 21?
Page 21 of the,
yes.
Yeah, that version. That should actually be section 22 in the middle on line 14A. Mm-hmm.
Page 21, line 14A.
That should say section 22.
Section
22, instead of 21, it should say 22.
This.
And then everything after that would be, the numbers should just remain the same. We just missed a numbering sequence there. So when Lori Freeman comes up, she'll be talking about the Dash 3 engrossed version by page and line number to try to help the dais and the audience kind of follow it through.
Great. With that, I'd like to call Lori Freeman up to walk us through the bill. Usually we... And if we need comments for explanation, we'll call individuals up when we need them.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
It should go without saying for anybody that knows Lori, but I feel compelled to say what an extraordinary effort she's made, including working on this all weekend while she was out of town at a wedding at the same time. She's my hero in this process.
It took her 10 hours just to do the DASH three amendments. So we all thank you very much.
You don't give us any more, and we'll be good.
Lori.
Thank you, Chair Mona Sanderson and Representative Green. Lori Freeman, Office of Legislative Counsel. And what I'm going to do is just walk you through the hand-engrossed version of House Bill 3650 that Rick's office put together for you. And I'm going to just try to cover the main substantive issues. For example, we changed where the reference is behavioral health. We changed that to chemical dependency and mental health. But, you know, there were other small changes like that that may not highlight as we go through, but if there are questions, I'm happy to answer them. So, beginning on page 1 and continuing on to page 2, we deleted the whereas clauses. And then on page 2, lines 17 to 18, we restored the language of ORS 414.018. That states it is the intention of the Legislative Assembly to achieve the goals of universal access to an adequate level of high-quality care at an affordable cost. On line 36 of page 2, there had been one of the comments was that this line gave the impression that only people who were dually eligible would participate in the coordinated care organizations, so we added a phrase at the end to make it clear that that would be in addition to the medical assistance recipients. On page 3, what are marked as lines 7A and 7B, there was some concern about...
And colleagues, if you want to ask questions as she's going through, please let me know.
There was concern about protecting the graduate medical education payments that teaching hospitals receive, and we actually had there was some very specific language proposed, but we added this new paragraph H. Monies provided by the federal government for medical education are allocated to the institutions that provide the medical training. And that just says that you have to make sure that those institutions keep getting the money instead of going into the detail that had been proposed. Lines 12 and 13, we deleted a requirement that wages and benefits would be at a level that reduce turnover and increase experience and quality of care.
Are there people that will agree with that or disagree with that?
Well, I have some concerns about that. I'd like to know why it was taken out and who proposed it be taken out.
We chairs, we're trying to get consensus on where we could get the votes in our caucuses, and that was an item, and that was why we felt that there were certain members we would not have a majority of votes. Yes, Representative Freeman.
As we go through this, there'll be quite a few things that I believe are workforce issues for a CCO to work on, and that are inappropriate to be in a piece of legislation. I would tell you any good business would do that. We don't need to put it in statute.
So this was negotiated, the idea to take this out was negotiated amongst the co-chairs?
The chairs, and now that's why we bring it here, and we need the conversation now.
Okay. Okay. And final question, was that proposed by an outside group that this be brought out, or it was just negotiated amongst you? Okay.
Senator Morris.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I concur with Representative Freeman on this issue, Senator. In reviewing this issue with my provider community in Lynn, Benton, Lincoln counties, the workforce is not a concern, at least in my district. And I think if you're getting into statutes that are talking about benefits in the context of reducing cost and expanding workforce when you have available workforce to do the job, but we're moving in the wrong direction. I also have an issue with lines 14 and 15. Provide an opportunity for frontline care providers to have a voice in their workplace. I'm not sure that's appropriate in statute. I fundamentally believe that, but I'm not sure that it's appropriate in statute, and I draw that to your attention as well.
I would like to know if there are others who agree or disagree with that statement. We have to be making these decisions in the next couple of weeks. So we chairs anyway would like to know. Yes, Senator Cruz.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I would agree with that. Plus, I think a whole lot of Section 1 is just another bunch of whereases. And we eliminated the whereases, but we still got them in there. You know, it's the intent, blah, blah, blah. It's, you know, I mean, the definitions, I think, are appropriate, but I've never been that fond of putting what our intent is in statute. It's what we're doing that should be in statute.
And I think that we know that there is already a workforce out there. The Home Care Commission has already trained very dedicated, and I think would be very good in a CCO. So we do address that issue later on and when we get to the Home Care Commission, we'll continue that conversation. Other comments? Senator Coquette, Representative Coquette.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the statements on lines 8 and 9 of page 3 about the need for a diverse and skilled workforce, do we agree on that value? I mean, we are setting out what we think will make this system work. And if we don't have a stable, skilled workforce, it's not going to happen. So and maybe this isn't the right language, but I think it's important for us to set forth some principles if we're going to actually make this work. So I'm comfortable with 12 through 15, but just wanted to register that. Maybe we have to have more conversation with it.
Chris?
Yeah, Madam Chair, you know, a lot of the intent and what we wanted to do was pretty well delineated 2 years ago in 2009. This should be more of the work plan, not the intent. I think the intent's already been pretty well delineated in 2009.
And my comment would be that I like lines 8, 9, 10, and 11, and it looks like no one is getting ready, wanting to get rid of build on existing training programs.
I'm sure.
Okay. Yes, Senator Reed.
I was really adamant getting rid of the whereases because I didn't think they did anything at all. But I think specifying the intent is not a trivial matter because I think there'll be items in here that are likely to end up one way or another in court, and intent becomes a question. And sometimes you have to divine intent from discussions and from other things. And I think it made sense to put the intent statements in here to make it very clear as we develop. It's a pretty amorphous concept right now, the CCO. It really doesn't hurt to have in background the notion of what it is we're intending to do with it. The taking out of 12 and 13 but leaving in 14 and 15 was a sort of a compromise in the discussions about what would make it appeal to one or the other of the caucus and caucuses and make it a poison pill to one or the other of the caucuses, and it was sort of half of one, six of one, half a dozen of the other, I think is how we got to taking out 12 and 13, but leaving in 14 and 15.
Again, we're working on compromise. Yes, Senator Bates.
I have a hard time understanding why 12 and 13 are out and 14, 15, and 16 are in. There's a problem that we dealt with before our home care workers, low wages, no benefits, and constant turnover. And the other issues we've dealt with are cost shift, low pay for providers, and they don't stay in the network. I think a simple statement driving to that is good enough. I'm not sure this actually gets us where we want to go, or you need this kind of down-the-weeds information. That's just where I'm at. Others may not agree. We've had this kind of language before in bills, and Senate Bill 50 had it way back. Yeah, it's not something we've been deeply involved in, so look at this.
Again, you'll see where the chairs were coming from, because there was obviously discussion on this, and we thought this had to be brought to you. All right, this is food for thought. We're going to have to get back with our caucuses, and the three chairs will say what is a...
Okay. And we only have three opinions among the nine of us.
That's right, so we have
leave
to
leave both of them in, leave one of them in, or leave neither of them in. Oh, no, there's four opinions. Or take out all the intent clauses. So, some way, it shouldn't be hard to resolve. You get about two votes for each, plus three in one of them.
Gosh, okay. There aren't even any lawyers here.
Yes, Lori's going.
Okay, now we're on to page 4 of the handwritten version. And the first change appears at lines 18A and B. And this sentence was added just to make clear that the Oregon Health Authority couldn't just contract with one statewide CCO. Because before the language had said a coordinated care organization may be a local community-based organization or a statewide organization, and there was some concern that that left open the possibility of just contracting with one statewide organization. So we added lines 18A and B to make it clear that it couldn't be just one. And then on line 20...
Lori, can I?
Yes.
Can I ask you a question? Lori, I think we want to make clear here. Line 17, is that three organizations or is it two organizations? Does local modify community-based? So you have a local community-based or a statewide? Or is the intent to be a local, a community-based, or a statewide? I think we're talking about two organizations, right?
Senator Mona Sanderson, Representative Greenlick, yes, I believe that's two organizations, either a local community-based organization
or
a statewide.
Thank you.
On line 20, this is the beginning of a list of the criteria that have to be adopted by the authority for the coordinated care organization. Now, later on, we make it clear that the authority comes up with the criteria, takes it to the Joint Interim Committee for approval, but this is the criteria for the OHA to come up with the original qualification criteria, which would then subsequently be approved. And before, line 20 said that the criteria must ensure that, and we just made that a little more squishy by saying the criteria must be designed so that, so you don't have to ensure that all of those things happen, but that should be the goal. Lines 40 through 42, we deleted the statement that each CCO must have a formal contractual relationship with the mental health and public health authorities in the counties. Instead, we made some substantial modifications to 414 2.153.
On page 21.
On page 21, and so I'll go back over that when we get that far.
And I think it's important to know that when we chairs were talking about the role of the counties, and I'll start out right now, that we feel that this piece probably needs to be worked on in the global budgeting process because of the funding streams and the safety net and the interrelation between that. And then when the authority develops its business plan and what the global budgeting is, they will then present that to the Legislative Assembly. Now, that's sort of the intent of what we wanted, and I know there's a lot of angst about the role of the county mental health and public health, and I think that truly has to be worked out because we cannot decimate our safety net. So it's sort of put into the global budgeting process, and I don't know if we need Bruce Goldberg to just comment on that piece, let's just wait till we get to the global budgeting piece. Yes, Senator
Shields. Thank you, Madam Chair. Before we go on to the next page, the first paragraph of Section 4 sparked a question in me. Is it the intention of the co-chairs of this committee that if a county decides that it wants to be a CCO, that they would be precluded from being a CCO? Is that the intention here?
No. I think a
Absolutely not.
No, I can see a county becoming a CCO if they wanted to, or they would contract with a CCO.
Okay. I think in correspondence I've had with legislative council, we were concerned that the way that the bill was written would preclude that. I would recommend that be changed for the next batch if that's the intention of the co-chairs. And I agree with that. I don't think counties should be precluded from taking this on if they decide that they want to pursue it.
How does the committee feel about that?
Certainly not my intention to believe that excluded a county
from
being.
Absolutely.
Yes, Madam Chair, I can also see a scenario where you could have two or three organizations, a county, an MCO hospital, for example, being at the same level, so one's not superior over the other. So we need to have the flexibility for any kind of structure that's going to work to be there. So you don't have to have one person as the chair. It could be equals at the table.
Absolutely.
So it wasn't our intent. Yes.
No. I'm just stating.
And then,
Senator Shields.
Madam Co-Chair, thank you. So I would also suggest that we might need to make some modifications to what was Section 22 that also references what a CCO is.
And let's wait till we get there then.
I just wanted to get that on the record. Right.
And then she mentioned about lines 42A and 42B. It was not our intent. Our DCOs that exist right now, there's going to be a transition period. They will be having contracts with OHA, and they can possibly be having contracts with a CCO. We don't, and I think that was a concern from the DCOs, and it's our intent that maybe on this line, or maybe it shouldn't even be here, it should be somewhere else. Each coordinated care organization provides a contract to provide dental health services where no DCO exists, to at least start out that way. Because there are areas, we want dental care to be given to everybody, but there are places in the state that don't have a DCO.
Still outside.
And so I think that we need to get that clarified. And in talking with the health authority and with the dental care organizations, this seems to be the best remedy.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I may be in error in this. I believe that each area of the state does have a DCO at the present time. I think maybe just misspoke. And my sense was that they are functioning extremely well. Well, I'd like to see them ultimately have a relationship with the CCOs. That's one part of the system that's working well, but they will have to develop the relationships later. Maybe I'm wrong about that. I see Dr. Shurcliffe's in the audience.
But our intent is that the relationships stay with the Oregon Health Authority at this point in time until, and then we get later in the bill, it gives the date certain, and we may have you bring you up when we look later on, and maybe, yeah.
Okay.
Yes, Senator Morse?
I want to raise a different issue if you're ready to move on.
Well, where is everyone on the DCO?
I think we all agreed early that DCOs could stay independent until 2014, but there might be other ways to produce dental services and certain CCOs, and the intention was to leave room for that if that's the way it worked, or if a DCO wanted to come into a CCO on a voluntary basis before 2014.
We want a flexibility.
Oh, but that gets to the equal seats at the table sort of thing at some point.
And remember, the final product will be approved by the Legislative Assembly in 2012.
I hope not. I hope it'll be in place.
Madam Chair, are you suggesting additional language to the end of page 4?
Well, again, I think we need the DCOs and the Oregon Health Authority to help us with language, and hopefully they'll be taking a look at this and provide language that the co-chairs are going to look at
by tomorrow.
Well, I'm totally comfortable with the language that's been added on 42 and 42A and B. I don't know how we jump to the DCO conversation from there. I'm sorry, I lost the train.
Line 42A and 42B.
Yeah, it just says each CCO provides or contracts to provide dental health services.
Okay. There have been concerns given to us already, so that's why I'm bringing it up now to let you know that there are concerns, and we want to make sure that we get in writing what those concerns are.
Let's go.
Okay.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Frank. Senator Moore.
I do have a clarification issue, and this is in the context of workforce on lines page 31 and 32. What do we mean? Page 4, lines 31 and 32. Up on line 20, must be designed to, including through the use of community health workers and personal health navigators. But my question is in the context of a CCO that has adequate personnel and resources to perform all the functions, are we requiring that they expand their workforce? Or what is the intent of that language?
This was in the original version we looked at
right.
last
mm-hmm.
week.
Yes, Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Chair Moss Anderson. I think LC staff talked about on line 20 how we changed from must ensure to must be designed so, with the idea of realizing that not all communities are going to have the ability to do all these things day one. So instead of saying you're going to do all this before you get started, it says you can design and work towards it. Did I get that right?
Yes, Representative.
So, do you see where the change was made in line 20, Senator Moore?
Yes.
Yeah.
I think it's possible that the CCO could have this kind of work now, but I don't think it's going to be very common at the moment.
Well, my question is, are we creating a classification of employment and mandating the use of that employment in the CCOs? Is that the intent of this language?
We want the CCO to be able to have caseworkers
right.
to help their people, so we can, that's part of cutting costs, using case managers, et cetera, community health workers, and personal health navigators. So you'd have to ask Lori, this was our whole concept, is to decrease healthcare costs by having those with Medicaid and with chronic diseases to have someone working with them to avoid all of the hospitalizations and helping them with their diabetes, et cetera. So,
just as a clarification, we had the we're creating job classifications, and we had certification for these job classifications that would be determined by the health authority in previous language.
No.
I don't know whether it's still in this. Has it been removed?
No, that's specifically it. Let's wait till we get to Section 20. But the Section 20 is, that's one model that these people can get certified in, but and they don't have to use those people the way it's been written. There can be other ways to get to this, but I think the answer to your question is, has this been intended from the beginning, which was maybe the second Wednesday night meeting of the Wednesday night, that these kind of people are intended to be a part of the CCO. And, but they're not necessarily required to be trained as in Section 20.
And again, I think we've developed it in such a way that it can be phased in over a period of time. I mean, I think that's the discussion we had with that section on line 20 that allows, and I don't want to use the word permissive, but it allows it to happen over time. It doesn't have to all be there day one. I mean, that's the term you suggested would do that.
Well, the language, is it generic or is it specific to a job classification?
Generic.
Generic.
Okay.
It's a type of worker.
That was my question.
Chair, going to line 20, did you consider language that instead of saying be designed, that this language could say under this other section must, to the extent possible, ensure that? Was that the kind of language ever considered?
I don't know if those words were chosen. Differences are an odd word, Al.
That's probably.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, look to Lori for that legal mumbo jumbo.
Is that right again?
Well, I'm just thinking of the various differences we have geographically and capabilities in different parts of the state and what it might look like in Loma versus even Clackamas County. This is pretty prescriptive language. I'm worried about the rules that might come out of it.
Lori, can you explain to us, you know what our intent is.
Yeah, Madam Chair. Senator Bates, I think saying be designed so that is just as squishy as to the extent practicable. I think neither one is really legally enforceable. But I think the idea here is that in an ideal world, a CCO would meet all of this criteria, but a recognition that not all of them will be able to.
If I could offer Senator Bates, replace must with should be designed so that. That is real flexible. Rather than must. Should would allow the flexibility that Doc's talking about, I would think. Just a thought.
Squishy.
That's really squishy.
Yeah. But Madam Chair, we're doing an integrated plan that's going to take several years. Being a little squishy on the front end is probably appropriate.
Representative Kotek.
I just would hope as we proceed with these amendments that we keep in mind the weeks we spent with the community trying to come up with a model that would actually achieve our goals. And if we're too squishy and we're not directive enough, I don't think we're going to get where we need to go. So I think we should just be cautious about stepping too far back.
Okay, we're going to leave it. I'm ready to move on. We hear what the committee says.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to get some clarification from the discussion you had about lines 42A and B, contracting with the dental care organizations. I think when I drafted this language, I was under the understanding that the CCOs were to either offer dental health services or contract with the DCOs. But am I hearing you say that now they wouldn't contract with the DCOs, they would just continue to contract with OHA directly? The DCOs would.
Either.
Until 2014.
Either. And I think we're going to want language proposed to us, and we're going to be getting that by 5 o'clock tomorrow night.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. On page 4A, that was just an attempt to make some sense of the phrase, the responsibility of the organization for risk. It wasn't intended to make any substantive change, but just to flesh out what that really means.
Madam Chair, 4A is my favorite page of the whole bill.
Every line?
Well, from 45A down is my favorite part, so...
You wrote that.
Any problems? Okay. Moving right along. Page 5.
Page 5, lines 1 through 3A. There was a concern that we weren't, by being so prescriptive about who represents the community at large, that we might leave out some important actors. So we took out the prescriptive clause and just left that the governance structure must represent the community at large.
As one of three areas.
That's right. Lines 35 through 38.
Just a minute. There was some interest in the community advisory councils, and we had made... and I want to bring some of those forward to get the committee's input. Basically, I'm just going to read this and see what the committee feels. The issues around governance have not been addressed. There needs to be more clarity for the creation of community advisory councils. Language is too prescriptive about who will be on the governance board. The role of the advisory committee is to be advisory, not part of the governance. Language dealing with the coordination of services between counties and CCOs needs to be more clearly defined. The new amendments leave the flawed language in place and are far too prescriptive.
Let's go to the very first issue.
Okay.
The very first issue is the question, should the community be involved in the governance of the organization, or should there be some separate window dressing kind of advisory committee? And I think the decision in this model is that the governance of the organization, of a community care, a CCO, should both include the people who are at risk, the healthcare system, and the community. And that is prescriptive. And that doesn't mean, that says the community should be involved at the governance level rather than at some advisory level.
Representative Freeman.
Thank you. And I don't necessarily disagree, but I think it's important as we put these organizations together that are going to share risk and be in charge of trying to figure out how to absorb what could be a 19% plus cut in services, that those people that are having to make the financial decisions of running the company have that role. I think the consumers have a role to play in advising that governance structure, but I'm not sure they should have a vote on how the money's spent, being that they're not investing any money or having anything at risk. So I think there's a very careful balance that has to be crafted here. I'm not convinced that the current model and the way the bill's written or the amendment suggestions are exactly that balance.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I think in the very first day, we had a discussion about the nature of a CCO. And I pointed out that I thought there were two possible models for a CCO. One is a new kind of organization that really represented the community, including all the healthcare people, the community representatives, and the people who are taking risk in this as involved in the governance, a new kind of organization. Or a sort of MCO on steroids. And if the extent to which we're talking about is turning into an MCO on steroids, the notion is, okay, I've got Appalachia Valley MCO, and I've been working with the physicians, and I've had a contract now, and I'll say, okay, I'll bring the hospital in, and then my new version of my company will still be my company. I think we need to be true to the notion that we're creating new organizations here. Will MCOs be able to morph into these new organizations? I think many will. But when they morph into a new organization, they become a different organization. And it seems to me this is what... I don't know what the Gang of Six did in their secret meetings at Mahonia Hall, but I know what the 45 of us did in the Wednesday night meetings. We talked about creating a new form of community organization that had all the pieces in it to take responsibility. And ultimately, this is the most important decision we're going to make. And I think this is simply a reflection, a shadow on the cave wall of that decision. But we need to make that decision. Our CCO is to be something different than organizations we find in the community right now. And we have to come to grips with that one, I think.
Thank you, Senator. And I want to say this as respectfully as possible. I don't believe there was secret meetings at Mahonia Hall. I think a group of stakeholders was asked to come together and work with the governor to help work on this issue. I do believe that same group of stakeholders participated on Wednesday night with the rest of us. To characterize them as some kind of a secret, hidden group is not fair to this process or to those people that put the time and energy in. We had them up here last week. They disclosed what the conversations were, what the time was spent, and how they came to the table, and in no way do I want to disparage the work that they did.
And I want to make this statement as respectful as possible. I believe it was a secret group. I don't believe most of us knew what was going on. It was going on in parallel and subverting what was going on in the public meeting. And so far, we've bent over backwards to make sure the secret group has had the ascendancy of this, and I resent it, and I continue to resent it. I don't know why I wasted eight Wednesday night meetings, pretending I was actually doing something when there was somebody else that was doing it. I intend to be honest to what happened on Wednesday night. And we can do it that way, or we cannot do it.
I would like to see what the committee thinks of this statement. Governance of a coordinated care organization must reflect the responsibility for risk, the major components of the health care delivery system in the community at large. Flexibility is needed to address the operational needs of the CCO while remaining accountable to community values and population health needs. I don't see that in conflict at all with what either one of you said. Senator Bate.
Community input, both from providers and hospitals and individuals, is obviously going to be important here, but the bottom line for me is somebody has to take responsibility for that coordinated care organization, and that person or that entity is going to be the ones at risk for the global budget. And we're going to have, hopefully, global budgets for these organizations, because the real issue here is not only improving care, but to control costs in a system that's running away with itself. And so from my point of view, the organization that's at risk has to have the final governance on these with strong input from the community and from providers. But in the end, it's going to have to sometimes make tough decisions. And those decisions might be what you pay a hospital, what you pay a group of providers, or what your relationship with the county is as far as mental health, drug, and alcohol. Those are tough decisions in some areas. Not everyone's going to come to the table and say, gee, it's wonderful to be working with you, and I'll accept whatever you're going to pay me. So that organization has to make that decision, and is going to have to make a decision also where you spread that global money, where you get the best bang for your buck. And the only way I see that working is, you can call what you want to, but the CCO is going to have to be in a position that governance is where the risk is. I don't see any way of separating those out.
Do you feel that the consumers must have a role in the governance then?
I think they have a strong voice, but if they're not at risk. They don't take the risk. They've got skin in the game. They are very strongly in a position to advise, but not to make the final decisions.
Yes.
If 10% of the money is at risk money, so let's say your hospital says we're at risk, and they're at risk for 10% of the total money. 90% of the money is state money. It's citizens' money. And it's not a private corporation raising capital on their own and spending it the way they spend it. We're putting the basic money into that as a state enterprise. The entity that's willing to take the risk, the payer of last resort, needs to be an important part. But We're saying that as a state, we want to be represented in that organization. We're bringing 90% of the dollars. We want to be represented by having citizens in the governance talking about how to spend that state money, because that's the biggest chunk of the money to be spent. Whoever says we'll take the last bite, a county, a hospital, they need to be actively involved in it. And so do the people who are saying, I'm willing to work for, what, 70% of my cost? They need to be a part of it. But this is a, as I view it, this is a community enterprise. It's not a private business. Anybody wants to run this as a private business, they can sell stock, raise your capital, and go ahead and run it. But this is state money and federal money.
And federal money.
Me to work with the senators and you to work with to see what how we're going to resolve the role of consumers and the governance of the CCO and the risk.
Oh, that's right.
Before tomorrow.
Yeah. I'll work with the senators. You and, work with
the House. Oh, yeah. That's right.
Well, no.
I was trying to pull a fast one. Okay.
I'm going to say it's all due respect to my good friend. It's not just the consumer's money. For the most part, the people who consume Medicaid, it's not their money. It's the money of the entire people of the state who put tax money into this.
Exactly.
And so for that reason, just saying consumer, I have a little concern with. I still think...
It doesn't say consumer. It says the community at large.
Well, I think you said, somebody said consumer.
I did.
Yeah. So we'll make that debate for another time, but I'm still set on whoever has the risk, the organization has the risk, has the governance.
But Representative Thompson and then Senator.
I feel very strongly the community has to be involved in this. If we're asking a community to accept a new form of a healthcare system, it has to be something that they take pride in and they help build. Otherwise, it's something that we're doing to a community from the outside. That will not be accepted, particularly in rural communities. They have to have skin in the game. They have to have some decision-making power, and let's not kid ourselves. We're cutting the budget, so we're not rolling out an unlimited budget for a blue-ribbon healthcare system. We're going to have to make some pretty hard decisions about what's covered, what's not covered, and how we're going to deliver these services. So we're talking about a major change in the culture of medicine happening within a community, and I think the community has to have a stake in that. Because it affects them so completely.
What I'm hearing that there's going to be some language proposed by 5 o'clock tomorrow regarding that governance, and what I just read the first part of what governance is of a CCO, it seemed like everyone was okay with. We need to then, and then I heard that consumers have to have a strong voice, but they're not necessarily taking the risk. And so are they then, and then that gets to the issue of community advisory councils, and does that even need to be in statute then? I'm hearing that consumers need to have a strong voice. Should that voice be from the community advisory council, or I think I'm hearing that the consumers will have a strong voice in the governance, but not necessarily a voting member. Is that what I'm hearing?
That's not what you heard from me.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
I need to know, yes.
I just want to point out that as it's structured, let's see, this is page 4A, lines 43 to 44. Currently, the governance structure is required to include consumers.
Okay, I don't like that page as well as I thought I did.
Okay, I think that says it. Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think really what we're getting to is the question of legitimacy in the governance structure. And I think there's a way that you can have consumer representation that's legitimate, and you could also have consumer representation that's show representation. I think just because somebody receives the services doesn't mean they represent everybody that receives the services. And so one model we might want to look at is in the nonprofit world where you have a board of directors. There's one model where, you know, the board comes up with nominees and they appoint, and then the board votes on those board members, and that's how you become a board member. Another is the membership model, where a certain number of seats are actually put out to vote by the membership. A lot of nonprofits do that. And so that might be something that you look at, because I would hate for us to, for a board of directors to say, okay, we've got a consumer on the board. Maybe there's one or two of them. But they didn't come there in any legitimate way to actually say, hey, we represent this community. They just happen to be appointed to this position and they receive services. And then I think that they don't have the pull on the board then if they don't have that kind of legitimacy. If they come to the board in a way that they're elected, I think that's a whole different ballgame, and it gives them some real clout to say, I truly represent this particular group because they voted me into this position on the board. That's just something that you might want to consider.
Okay. All right, Senator Cruz, and then we're going to move on.
Okay. There's different levels, and to a degree, this has to be bifurcated. When we're looking at the structure of the organization, and we're looking at one of the key components that needs to be established is the risk model, and the risk model has to have the people that understand the risk model making that decision. It's, in all due respect, not a place for advocacy folks who don't understand the risk model, I mean, that's a key component of all of this. If we're talking a global budget, you have to assign risk, and it needs to be the people that understand that model that make those decisions. As far as the global policy, that's a different matter, but when it comes down to the actual running of the business, it needs to be the people that know how to run the business.
Okay, we're moving on. Lori.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I could just throw in one comment about the language that you suggested, just coming from a person who's drafting and cares about the precision of the law, when you add in the section about flexibility, you basically annul everything else that you've said before. So if you want to specify the components of governance but you don't really want to, then you put in the flexibility. But if you're serious about what you want the components of governance to be, then you don't put in that they need flexibility.
But we could, okay. We will deal with that.
Part of this is we're putting background in, and OHA is supposed to create the criteria by which they will judge it and bring it back to us. And that's where it seems to be the flexible comes to the specific, at which point we say, well, wait a minute, that's not what it would look like.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So
addressing this on Monday.
We're on page 5.
Already?
And I can't... It was so long ago, I don't remember if I covered this, but
yes,
35 through 38, I already covered that?
No.
Oh, okay. Lines 35 through 38, this just had said, with respect to people who are duly eligible for Medicare and Medicaid, that the CCO had to meet the federally required criteria. This deletes that subsection in the hope that if we don't want to go by the federal criteria, we could get a waiver or approval from the feds to deviate from that. Section 5 was, when I originally drafted it, it was my misunderstanding about the difference between alternative payment methodologies and global budgets. I thought one was a type of the other. So this has just been rewritten a little bit to clarify that a global budget is something different than an alternative payment methodology.
And then our understanding of what this meant was the global budget is what the state pays the CCO, and the alternative payment mechanisms were how the CCOs paid providers. And that's what we think we came out with. And that's the way Lori's framed it.
Moving on.
Page 6, we added this new language on lines 9A and B. just that the authority shall assist and support coordinated care organizations in identifying cost-cutting measures. And then the next line was to clarify that it's the coordinated care organization, not the authority, that's prohibited from reimbursing for never events.
Lines 42 and 43, there is concerns about the use of line 42, such procedures and methods shall maintain the rights and benefits of Medicare beneficiaries under Title 18 of the Social Security Act. The rights needs to really probably not be in there. If we, right now, someone in that's a part of Medicare has the right to opt into a supplemental Medicare. And this, we are going to mandate the dual eligibles to be in. And so and I'd like the Oregon Health Authority to talk to us about that.
There's nothing we can do to take away the rights of Medicare.
Bruce.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Bruce Goldberg, Director of the Oregon Health Authority. You'll see in another section of the bill we had worked out language which talked about Medicare beneficiaries being in CCOs and then having an opportunity to opt out as opposed to not being in and opting in. And I think there's a concern about a statement that says the rights and benefits of Medicare beneficiaries being in opposition to that opt-out clause. And so that's one of the pieces that we're looking to check on.
Because it could be, what you're saying is it could be that we want all of our dual eligibles and Medicaid to be in our CCO. With this language, this gives those dual eligibles the right to not be.
Correct. The idea was to have as many people in the community in these organizations, and so to allow, the default is that everybody is in a CCO, the dually eligibles, as well as the singly eligible for Medicaid. But to have a process whereby there is an opt-out if indeed a member's needs aren't being met. And the bill in another section spells out that process for a hearing and for an opportunity to opt out to be certain that people's needs are met.
Discussion. Okay, there will probably be language presented to us.
Yeah, I have a question. Right now, can a dual eligible person be a part of a Medicare supplemental plan?
They can be part of a Medicare supplemental plan, yes.
So in this case, you could force them out of that plan even though that's where they want to be and into a CCO? By taking away their right to stay in a Medicare supplement plan?
The goal is to take all of the Medicare dollars, and we need to work out the transition around Medicare Advantage and how that rolls into the CCO. But the notion is to create a single organization so that those who are dually eligible aren't part of a Medicaid as well as a Medicare organization, but to put the funding together. And that transition needs to be worked out.
And that.
Sure.
Okay.
All right. Okay,
thank you. All right. Moving
on. Then we should take this.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, members of the committee, page 7. This is the enrollment process that Dr. Goldberg was just referring to. We've replaced the language that was at 23 through 26 with the language that's at 26A through F, which just says OHA has to come up with an enrollment process that allows continuity of care and also allows the member to disenroll if the member doesn't receive adequate services promptly, and to then enroll in another CCO of the member's choice, and the member's choice was added, or possibly fee-for-service.
Right back to the same old, same old.
Page 7A, this was the language we had a lot of, or the committee had a lot of discussion about, this requirement that you may not unreasonably refuse to contract with the CCO, and there was concern that an individual provider might be forced into an arbitration process if the individual provider did not want to contract with the CCO. So we changed a provider on line 32 to a significant healthcare entity within a community.
And I know there's angst still out there, and they feel the new arbitration language doesn't really achieve the goal of making counties and hospitals participate in the new CCOs. Do you think that this language would allow make counties and hospitals participate in a CCO?
Madam Chair, I don't think there's anything in here that makes them participate.
Even the original language?
That's what line 32 through 34 says. They may not unreasonably refuse.
Well, okay, give me a second.
That's pretty prescriptive.
What's the...
Yeah, I think you're right. I think a county, to the extent that it provides care within a community, would probably be a significant healthcare entity. And then it would be subject to the dispute resolution procedures that are set forth on lines 36A to J.
A county and a hospital.
Those
are the big entities that we really want to be participating in a CCO.
Yes, Madam Chair. I assume that since we're using a sort of vague term there and it's not defined, that it would be up to the Oregon Health Authority to define what a significant healthcare entity is.
Incidentally, that should be in line 36G also. Rather than a provider. We wanted not to get confused that a provider was Dr. Bates in his office.
Well, I think of myself as a significant healthcare entity.
Well, you probably are down in your place.
Others may not see it that way, but I do.
So everyone's comfortable with this language and with the intent of the language, and we want to change provider in line 36G to make sure we include that healthcare entity. Yes, and Representative Freeman.
I want to hear again from
I'm not comfortable.
Lori.
This is strange.
Does this, in your estimation, eventually get to doing the same thing as what we took out? I mean, what we took out was any dispute arising from refusal to contract shall be resolved by an independent third-party arbitrator in a binding arbitration process prescribed by the authority. When you get down to number five and get to that kind of that last option, is it as restrictive as what we took out?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Freeman, they're actually subsections 4 and 5 are two different things. Okay. Subsection 4 just gets to the requirement that you contract, and if you don't, you go through, well,
you're right.
You get a preference in the contract.
Okay, so is C as restrictive as what we took out then?
Madam Chair, Representative Freeman, I think it's, since we're just giving preference to proposals that contain these mediation mechanisms, it's not as prescriptive.
But 4 says they can't unreasonably do it, and 5 says if they do unreasonably do it, they can't get any money from Medicaid. So that's what you were suggesting you wanted to do.
What I think some people are, but some people are proposing, is maybe we take out this section because we are mandating a private entity, and what are the legal ramifications of this, and then make the Oregon Health Authority put this in as a part of a CCO package, and find out what's legal on mandating this. I mean, that might be the best thing to do.
But take it out
and again, Health Authority, get up here.
What's that?
Take it out.
Leave it out. There's an idiomatic guarantee. They have to cooperate. And if they don't, the penalty is you stop giving them Medicaid money. You're not mandating anything.
Oh, they're not.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, I think this section is really about having the appropriate carrots and sticks to bring people together in a community that will all cooperate, all the providers as part of a coordinated care organization. I think one of the concerns is about some unintended consequences. In other words, if a provider does refuse and then doesn't receive any reimbursement, in essence, they wouldn't be a part of serving individuals at all. And so I think this may need a little bit of work to be certain that we get the appropriate carrots and sticks that bring people together. And I think we have to figure out how we can have CCOs where people come together, whether or not we can mandate it, what happens if they don't. And I'm not so sure. The mediation process is a nice step-down process, and we think that's good. I think the question is, what happens in the end if that doesn't work?
So we could direct the Health Authority to come back to the Legislative Assembly on how we are going to, what the carrot's going to be and what the stick's going to be?
Correct. As part of coming back with the CC, the bill says that we need to come back with the criteria for a CCO as well as for the global budget. And this could be a part of that kind of a package, is here's what a CCO is and here's how they'll be formed and here's how we'll deal with the situation of not having one major entity in a community hold hostage the entire process on one hand. And on the other hand, about mandating an entity and what happens if they don't do it. It's tricky.
There's a major constitutional issue here.
Yes, Senator Morris?
There's a major constitutional issue here. And I'm not sure that you can legally, by statute, mandate a private entity to contract for a service. I just don't think you can go there.
I wouldn't disagree. I think that's why we need some time to be certain that this reflects the appropriate incentives as well as potentially some disincentives, but not a mandate.
But all
Senator
you do,
Cruz?
Excuse me. Madam Chair, thank you. Bruce, I don't see any carrots here. All I see is sticks.
Correct.
And pure and simple. And I see the potential in this in setting up a situation where the health authority will decide who's the chief, and then they go negotiate with the other Indians in the tribe, and if the Indians don't think they're getting a fair shake, they say no, then they go back to you and you're judge and jury. This is really problematic here. You need to find at least one or two carrots in this thing, and so far it's all sticks.
Representative Thompson?
How does this section work in an area where at the inception we're going to have two or three CCO organizations vying for the business in the setup phase? Does Dr. Bates have to roll over and agree to be parts of all three of them because he's a significant provider?
Mm-hmm.
And he chooses which CCO he wants to be part of, and as long as he's part of one of them, it satisfies the conditions.
Let's say, for the example, that Dr. Bates was a sole provider in an area, and in that way, a significant provider. It would be very difficult for a CCO to come forward and be able to say, we have access and we have providers in a community, if they didn't have Dr. Bates as part of that. Dr. Bates could potentially be a part of all three. he could be a part of just one. But by definition, that would mean that the other two wouldn't be able to meet the criteria for what would really make up a CCO. You could think about that as a hospital. It's important that a CCO bring together all of the pieces of an organ of a community.
Representative, yes.
Yeah. I think the problem is talking about Dr. Bates as a significant healthcare entity, even though everybody knows he is. I think we're basically, in this case, talking about entities that, in fact, need to be a part of a healthcare system. We're talking about hospitals and counties. And the issue isn't forcing them to do anything. It's simply saying, if you want to be a part of getting paid by Medicaid, then you need to be prepared to work with the way we're moving with Medicaid payments. It doesn't take away their license. It doesn't do anything but that. Five simply says, if you want to get paid for dealing with Medicaid patients, join the game. I mean...
So, Lori, do you sort of get the direction?
No. No, this is a critical issue.
I feel that is a real issue. Yes, Senator Morris, but to follow up on my thought,
I think we need to
develop language that would direct the health authority, I assume the health authority, in developing contract negotiations. I don't know how to... And Senator Morris and Senator Freeman have really good suggestions.
Well, I do have a question. If you think about our delivery system, we have some systems that are integrated with hospitals and physicians. You have hospitals that are freestanding, and they extend privileges to independent practices to practice in that hospital. How are you going to force an independent practice into this coordinated care organization in the context of we're going to pay you a whole lot less money than what you have been getting? I just don't know how you do it.
Representative Freeman?
Thank you. My understanding of this section had to do with making sure the significant players in the community would come together to deliver health care, not individual practitioners.
Correct.
And I know you used an example of a single doctor in a single town. Well, my thought is that's not going to be a CCO. That's going to be a great doctor like Dr. Bates taking care of his neighbors. I think this is a bigger discussion. I'm not opposed to putting the original language as part of C in that section for the arbitration, because I do like the idea of, hey, let's try to sit down and work it out before we bring an arbitrator in. And I think that's what A and B talk about doing. And then I think the original language is what I thought C sort of meant. So, but all that being said, it seems a little odd that we're kind of talking about these decisions knowing that we have folks that are asked to come to talk about what the amendments are. So I don't know timing-wise when they're going to get to talk, but I think they could help us understand a little bit of what we're doing here.
I would ask that people who want to address the... Oh, pardon?
I'd be willing to take this all out and work it out community by community.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I think Mitch and I may agree that this is really a key... Mitch and I agree. This is really a key... This is really a key part of getting a CCO going. It's just the key to it. And we knew from the beginning this was going to be a problem. You know, can a privatization force a county to do something? I don't think so. There may be some constitutional problems there. Can they say the services the county gives they're not going to fund? They're going to do drug and alcohol and mental health on their own? I can see that happening. And we've seen that happen in counties around the state. I'm a little concerned about a significant number of positions in a group, say a specialty group, it's the only specialty group in that area saying no to this and trying to work something relation out with them. And then the third group is obviously the hospitals. And hospitals have less choice than anybody else. They're not going to be, out here defending hospitals. We battle back and forth all the time as friendly antagonists. But in the end, they have to see these patients, whether they have a contract or not, or whether or not they're on fee-for-service with them. They're required under federal law to see patients. And so they're going to be into this thing one way or the other. I think you can bring them in actually easier than the first two groups. But this has to be rewritten. This is, with all due respect, I don't think this gets us really where we want to be. It's a good try at it, but the more I think about it, this is going to take, sit down, think about it very carefully for a few hours, and bring those entities in. Bring some counties in, bring some hospitals in, and say, how do we get language going here that in some way it's reasonable to get this coordinated care organization going? I mean, in some parts of the state, the coordinated care organization may be the hospital itself, and the MCO or whatever other group may feel uncomfortable. Other places, the MCO may be the coordinated care organization bringing in the hospital. So there's lots of ways it's going to be mixed. You know that from your area. So I think we need to pull this and rewrite it.
What about just taking out that first part of four, leaving the dispute resolution piece in, which seems like a useful piece, and then taking five out and begging the question about forcing anybody in?
Why don't we have those stakeholders out there bring their suggestions on this piece, and then we'll look at them all and try to figure it out.
But
and
I
bring
think
it back
the sense
to the
of the, I'm hearing the sense of this committee is that they don't want the force. For
yes.
Somebody in it. Is that the sense that we're getting?
Representative Kotek?
I think the key phrases for me in this section, I'm comfortable with this. I think defining what unreasonably refuse would be helpful.
Be done by rule.
I mean, if they have a reasonable explanation of why they won't want a contract, that's one thing. But if they just don't want to do it because they don't like the other person or they like the other, the CCO, that's a... I think they have to have a reason for not wanting to contract. So that's the key piece for me.
Yeah.
I'm not that uncomfortable if we understand what unreasonably refused means.
You want to force everybody...
So I think we're going to be getting language.
Yeah, Madam Chair, that is a phrase that's vague enough that it would be up to OHA to decide what was unreasonable and what was a refusal.
Okay.
And we're trying to get through this. And I think the third-party arbitrator could help determine that. I mean, I think that's the way it's originally written, has that person there to sit down and say, you guys just aren't getting along. Let's get this done. Or, yeah, you got a good reason not to be in.
Madam Chair,
yes.
Remember, these providers are free agents. They don't have to practice in Oregon. And if you take a specialty or a subspecialty group, and you force them into a major part of their practice where they're losing money.
We're talking about doctors in this case.
For their providers.
No, that's why we changed the name. I mean, it's clear. We're not talking about doctors here. There was no intention to be talking about physicians in this.
Then who?
A significant healthcare entity that has a clinic practice.
I suppose.
Large clinic practice, certain specialty.
Even hospitals have doctors in them.
Yeah, but the doctors aren't what the hospital is built for, mostly.
Sure, you write that down. Hospitals have doctors in them. That's important to know.
Some hospitals don't.
We will be coming back with language, and we hear what the committee, most of the committee says. Yeah. Okay. Moving right along.
So be careful with language. This is important. Really important. To be careful. I'm not sure we're there yet.
No, it's too
prescriptive. Page 8.
Too prescriptive.
Are we there yet?
All right.
Page 8.
Into a situation, they're losing money. It's the same thing. Lose it.
So lines 15A and B. What we're attempting to do here is there was a concern that. The language, the original language, it said the authority shall publish the information collected under this section at aggregate levels that do not disclose information otherwise protected by law, that might also protect information by CCO. So in other words, you wouldn't be able to find out quality measures about a particular CCO. So 15A and B is just to try to make clear that it's we're really just talking about health information about individuals that has to be protected, but the information that's published must be published by CCO.
Moving on.
Page 9. Okay, this on lines 10 through 12, there was discussion in the committee that, one, the rollout of this system won't be subject to the availability of funds because we have what we have, but instead it will be subject to the availability of coordinated care organizations coming online. So I just revised the language to reflect that. And then we took out all of the language that's lines 13 through 45 on that page, which was about the interim global budget process, because now we've set it up that the OHA is to come up with something by October 1st and bring it to the Joint Committee. And once it gets approved, soon after that, they can begin, the global budget process. Soon after that, then they can begin contracting.
And the quality. It's in the next page.
But this is another area I've received a lot of negative comments and really feel that it needs to come back to the Legislative Assembly. I'd like...
Well, the only problem with that is it means... It won't start for 9 months later.
Yes, and Representative Freeman.
And there is a rush for cost savings here, but if you start looking at the timeline, and Dr. Goldberg could talk to the timeline some, by the time we get the federal waivers, by the time we get the organizations together, it's virtually going to be the February timeline anyway. So I'm not uncomfortable in I'm one of those that push for the expediency as much as anybody else. As one of the co-chairs of the subcommittee, I'm very conscious of the cost savings that's supposed to be achieved here. But I do recognize that the importance of having the full legislative body to look at this and make sure we get it right. So could you speak a little of the timeline?
Chair Mona Sanderson, Rep. Freeman, I think actually you've outlined it as well as I could. I think the balance here is about getting the full legislative assembly to buy in, and our sense is it's going to. We need to move this forward as quickly as possible. One of the big pieces is going to A, get the work done that we need to do around a global budget, around the. Quality and outcome standards, et cetera. Then we're going to need to negotiate that with CMS. And we've always felt that in the best of all worlds, we were looking at a November approval. And so you're correct that November of 2011. That the difference between November 2011 and February 2012 is but a couple of months, and so we don't think that that's going to be something that will make or break this. It'd be nice to have the flexibility, but you have to also balance that certainly with the need for the legislative buy-in, and we may not get CMS approval until February. That's certainly something that we're going to work as hard as we can to do.
Representative
Greenwood. But Bruce, my understanding is you can't go to the Fed without saying what a CCO is. And you can't go to the Fed without saying what a global budget is, because that's what you're asking to exempt. And so I would say if we change this, you can't begin negotiating with the Fed until we've approved it, say March 1st. I think the notion here was to give you feedback on what you were going to take to the Fed and your definition of how the global budget is going to work and what the nature of a CCO is. And there'll be a chance to come back in February after that, but are you comfortable to go and begin negotiating with the Fed with a process that hasn't come to the hasn't had any legislative feedback?
I've always seen this as our working in sync with both bodies. with working. I'm assuming that there would be an interim legislative committee that we would periodically report to and get some feedback and direction to. At the same time, we would be working with with CMS, and that we would have enough specificity that we could get buy-off from CMS. We would need to come back to the legislature. Certainly, if the legislature changed it, we would need to go back to CMS and let them know what those changes were. But I have always anticipated that we would be moving forward enough in sync that any changes that were made wouldn't be so significant that it would cause us to go back to CMS and sort of begin the process again.
But what it says in line, those first lines on page 9A, is that, you see that as being a problem?
Here.
I mean, that's what I think you just said.
No, I don't see this as being a problem. Nor,
that's what's being objected to, is this.
Nor, however, do I see there as a problem to coming back to the full Legislative Assembly.
Madam Chair?
Yes, anyone?
Okay with me.
We have broken this ground with Senate Bill 99,
yep.
And we have closed that loop at least with one half of the Assembly. A feedback loop, a process of monitoring along the way, and affirmative action in February. I would suggest that we look at that language in Senate Bill 99 and see how it might fit in this process. Because I know that on our side of the Assembly, that was a very, very critical component of it. And I believe it will be similarly, if not more important, definitely more important.
We've been clear, and the Governor's been very clear about needing to have that legislative approval. And I think this is really just a question of how and when that takes place, and we're very comfortable in where the legislature lands.
Representative Freeman.
I think we're all virtually saying the same thing. I think we just got to get the words on the piece of paper right that include
the
final buy-off on with the full Legislative Assembly. Because
it's
important that we work together as we get to there, that we don't just leave the building and you work for several months, do a bunch of waivers, come back in February and we say, oh, that's not what we meant. But on the same token, I don't think it's, if it happens to be this committee or whatever appropriate committee, I don't think a subgroup of the legislature should be making the final approval.
I think it's adding that final legislative piece to work with the committee and then
right.
Have there be a final.
I think if we're going to do that, I would prefer to say it has to have legislative approval before you can go to the Fed for a waiver. I mean, if you're not in any hurry, then I'd say let's do it that way. Because I think it's a real problem. I don't think we speak for the legislature. So, I mean, if we don't, so the answer is, okay, let's stall it until February. We'll come in and get legislative approval, and then
I think that would slow us down to where we wouldn't then get approval till the
Representative
summer.
Freeman.
Well, the other problem with that, and I understand what you're saying, but the other problem is if you do it, you won't know what waivers you were granted to make the final decision. So this is a little bit egg and chicken. So, I mean, I think it is parallel tracks where, to the extent you can be communicating with the legislative committee that's dealing with this, so that we're not going in opposite directions, but understand fully the intent and the final buy-off will be the full legislative body, is really the only way to move forward in a parallel track. Because, again, if not, you won't know what to ask for, and we won't know what you're getting. So it's, I think this section needs a little bit of work, but I think we're virtually there.
Yes, Senator Cruz?
If I might suggest to accomplish both, because I do think final approval needs to come from the full Legislative Assembly. This is something that was done years ago. And I would suggest, for example, that we be relatively definitive that the touch points of your work are back to this committee, and we make sure this committee goes into the interim, and then you would make your request to e-board, and we would require, and we would report to the e-board on our recommendations.
The e-board is not legislative approval.
It is in the interim.
No, it isn't. The board does not have.
We can put the authority. We can put the authority in budgets. We can. It can be written so that the E board can have the ability to do that, and that can be in a budget. But I guess the point I'm saying, Madam Chair, is, and it's something we've done before, is not just to have the agency come in and make a presentation to the E board, but also it can be written so that the approval of this, that this committee also reports to the e-board at the same time. It's been done before.
Will you write up language? My preference is, man, I disagree with Representative Greenlink on waiting to even submit a waiver. We still need the final.
I think we can come up with some language that provides the appropriate speed, the appropriate ability to check in with a legislative committee like this that has some experience, and some final check off from the full legislature.
Okay.
And I think we can put something together for you to look at.
Okay, don't go away. I'm going to just bring up the Med-Mal piece right here.
Yeah.
Okay. In section on page 9A, it states the Oregon Health Authority shall develop qualification criteria for coordinated care organizations and shall develop a global budgeting process and develop a medical liability process. I want to know what the committee feels about that.
No.
No. The OHA didn't do that?
Well, that's what one of our bills was that we submitted. And we're talking about medical liability. Why not give the Oregon Health Authority to develop the process? That was one of our suggestions.
Yeah, Madam Chair, maybe this is a time to address that. I'd like to make a strong recommendation that if we want to save this bill, if you want transformation to pass out of this assembly, there's a way to do it and address the medical malpractice liability issue. I believe the way that you do that is, and before we get to that, I'd like to go back and look at the assumed cost savings that were presented to us in our gang of 45.
48.
48?
Yeah.
High
40s.
Okay. There
were
a lot of us.
Even 50, whatever.
Yeah. Of the total savings of 321 million dollars, the largest portion of that, $185 million of general funds from unwarranted use, inappropriate choice of diagnostics, inappropriate surgery, inappropriate treatment. All of that is addressing defensive medicine. That is defensive medicine front and center. How do you effectuate those changes and those savings if we don't address the medical liability and the risk component of delivering care? My solution, recommended solution, is that we write into this bill that concurrent with the developing of the criteria and the global budgeting and the terms of the coordinated care organization, a requirement for the Oregon Health Authority to address defensive medicine and recommend proposals that would in fact change physician practice. Now, you can't get there without looking at medical malpractice. One of the big objections that has arisen out of this, you know, it's pretty strong. I hear a lot of people feel very strongly about this, is a lack of process, This would provide that process. It would come back and concurrent with adoption in February of the final plan for the CCOs, you would have the ability to weigh in on thoughtful legislation that would affect defensive medicine.
Inside the CCO?
No, I'm talking about, when we're talking about the triple aim and the work of the Health Policy Board, that isn't just the Medicaid publicly assisted population. That's all of medicine.
This bill is about Oregon Health Plan.
But this bill has a relating clause relating to health. And it's an opportunity to bring this forward in a thoughtful way that preserves this and moves it forward without making a decision today, but you set a process in motion that said, we are going to address this. And there are those of us in the Assembly that feel very strongly that this issue has been put off and put off and put off. This is an opportunity to bring forward a thoughtful solution. Now, it may not find favor in the Assembly, but at least we'll have something different than the presentation that was given to us in our gang of 45 or 48 with respect to what we are doing to address defensive medicine and the cost of these unwarranted procedures and things that are driving up the cost of medicine. And I think that might find a window of opportunity that would say, yeah, this makes sense. Let's go down the road and we'll vote for this bill.
Representative Freeman.
Thank you. I'm going to, again, put on my Ways and Means Subcommittee of Human Service co-chair hat. We have to figure out how to capture these savings. So, Senator Morris just explained how it is the health authority even started this dialogue, how the governor put his budget together. And I think it's imperative that we look for those cost containments, and I am convinced that we won't get that solved in the next 2 weeks. So looking for a process moving forward, I am excited to explore.
So what I, oh yes, Representative Freeman.
Two things. First of all, I spent many years studying medical care utilization patterns. And I think it's a myth that most of those unnecessary procedures and wrong procedures are defensive medicine. If you want to know what I think the main driver is, it's the fee-for-service medical care system. People perform more than they need because they get paid for providing more than they need, not because they think it's going to reduce their malpractice coverage. The other thing is a political issue. I think you attempt to burden this bill with an overall tort reform piece, and it's going to fail. It's not going to get out of this committee, I can tell you.
Well, let's. I still believe that the Legislative Assembly would like.
Let me finish my sentence.
Oh, I thought you were finished.
No, I was right in the middle of a sentence.
Just warming up.
just let me finish my sentence. I mean, it seems to me it's perfectly appropriate to put something like this in as a start for tort reform inside the CCOs. For the Medicaid population. I have no problem with that. In fact, I think we should put that in. But I do not think we can. First of all, I don't think the health authority is the proper place for the decision on overall tort reform. I think it's the legislature is the proper place for that.
Oh, I feel that the health authority can at least address the medical liability process that they can have the proper stakeholders involved in that process, because right now we haven't had all of the stakeholders involved, and so I feel I would like to see language from the health authority that could fit in right here on that piece. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think one of the challenges I have with this conversation is I've heard three things. I've heard defensive medicine, I've heard medical malpractice, I've heard tort reform. They're not all synonymous in my head. If we're going to talk about defensive medicine, I think there are some people assume that it's a tort issue. You hear from Representative Green like that's not necessarily the case. What I would like to see, and out of respect for Senator Morse, is I'd like to see the language you would like to recommend around defensive medicine, and if we can say that we're going to get an evidence-based report back on defensive medicine, I might be able to go there. But if we're going to talk about medical mal and tort reform as the assumed reasoning for defensive medicine, I think that's jumping ahead and not knowing actually the true cause of the issue.
Let me just bring it down to an anecdotal specific instance. I presented this concept to the Samaritan Health Services annual retreat on Saturday and went through the outline of expected savings, and I had one of the physicians on the board came up to me at the break, and he said, now let me get this straight. You're going to reduce my compensation, and you're going to have me operate in a global budget where I am rationing care, and I'm going to be 100% at risk. He said, that doesn't work. So look at it through the eyes of the people that are going to be delivering this care with reduced income and actually having to make decisions in a clinical setting that say, no, we're not going to do this, but on the other hand, I'm totally at risk. Is that a model that works? And I would suggest that if you're actually serious about reducing cost, that that's a major component to consider. Not to answer the question today or in the next 2 weeks, but to set in motion a thoughtful process and said, okay, we are going to address that. We've set out the target here. It's $185 million we want to save. And we call it unwarranted use, inappropriate choice of diagnostics, inappropriate surgery, and inappropriate treatment. That's out of the Oregon Health Authority's presentation. How are you going to change that?
I'll give you a way to change it.
Wait, Representative Kotek, then Representative... No? Okay.
I'll pass.
Representative Thompson, and then Representative...
Yeah, I think this is a hugely important issue, and there's one other element in it. We set up these CCOs without tort reform. I think we're setting them up to be the deep pockets. So I'm not going to sue the doctor if I'm unhappy with my treatment. I'm going to sue the doctor and the CCO because the CCO is taking on the role of the quality guide for how this whole program goes together. And they're going to be responsible for what gets covered in the global budget or not. I think we've got a whole new level of risk that we're building in if we don't get tort reform right on the way in. And I agree with you. I've talked to a number of doctors, that same thing. They're just, hey, it's a no deal with us taking all the risk and not getting anything on the benefit end. I think it's a huge issue.
Were you next, Representative Bernal?
We're talking about alternative payment model. You want an alternative payment model that will solve that? You give a surgeon a fixed amount of money as a salary, and you have him pay $1,000 out of that salary every time he performs an operation. That'll reduce surgery use. You give the same thing you give a physician, a fixed amount of money, more than they have now, but a fixed amount of money, and you have them pay $500 every time they order an MRI. In 2 years, you'll see surgical rates plummet and MRI use plummet, because it's the fee-for-service system that causes that. It's not defensive medicine.
Okay, Senator Bates and then Senator Shields, and then we're going to move on, but we would like to have language developing a process. You know we're not going to come up with a system in 2 weeks, but I do believe that this needs to be addressed, and I think everybody feels it needs to be addressed,
put together
except for one
some,
or two.
Some language. It's a piece of the
okay.
puzzle.
We'll be the only physician on this board. I'll tell you, I don't have any personal dog in the fight, so we'll start there. It's an unprejudiced, unbiased position. I think this is an opportunity to have a discussion, a thoughtful discussion, in a more open way than we've had before in this building. It's always in side halls and sideways, and small groups getting together, and no one really coming to any conclusion that's based on anything other than anecdotal histories and fears. I think this is an opportunity to have that discussion and do it over a period of time and bring the right people in. I think the authority can bring those people in. Tort lawyers and physicians and people who've looked at this, as Representative Mitch Greenlick has, and see if there is something that's appropriate to be done that does drive down cost. That's the main thing I'm concerned about, is driving down cost. I think there's some truth to what everyone's said here. Not everything that physicians do is excessive is in order to protect themselves against medical malpractice. Some of it is and some of it isn't. And in many times in our own minds, we cannot separate those out. And that's the truth. We don't want to miss something with a patient. We don't want to hurt a patient. And at the same time, I know I've ordered things that I could have waited a while long on, maybe not ordered later on, but because of my fear of a lawsuit, I went and ordered it. Now, other times, it's just good practice, or I'm just a little nervous about that patient. So there's no clear picture here. And I think what everyone has said here to a great degree is true. But we really do need to have an opportunity to have that discussion. And that's why I'm supporting what you're suggesting here, is to have that discussion, see what comes from it, see if there's something reasonable that we can do that will actually bring down health care costs. And I think we need to have that discussion.
Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but what I saw at the presentation in the Gang of 45, people might not have liked the conclusion that that task force or presented to us, but it didn't seem to, they didn't seem to indicate that there was much there in the way of cost savings. That was my impression. The other part that I would like to mention that I mentioned before is that medical malpractice premiums are down significantly from where they've been over, just over the last 10 years. And my concern, and while I do appreciate that this is seen as an opportunity to push this issue forward, this bill, I'm afraid if we do include it in this bill, it's going to blow up the entire bill.
I'd suggest if you have a trial lawyer leading the group that's going to explore tort reform, that's what you're going to come up with, was what we saw.
Okay, what we're going to do is have some language and then take the temperature of our caucuses and see with what will be proposed by 5 o'clock tomorrow.
Madam Chair, do you mean doing this instead of what we were talking about before with including the CCOs under the state tort cap? Is that would be the malpractice piece we do?
It's that piece will not fly in the Senate. I know that one is dead.
Okay, so what we substitute for that, let me make clear what we're hearing now. Is language that would have OHA form a task force to look at this question?
Or a process. Okay. And we, okay, Lori, we need to, and we may not get to our public hearing, everybody. I'm so, I apologize, but this is far, so important for this committee to have this discussion. So we already talked about what was at the bottom of 9A, and we are going to get language from the stakeholders on the, on those changes. 9B, moving on.
Okay, so, Madam Chair, members of the committee, we have on 9A,
exactly.
We have a new section 12A, and a lot of the, there are some other changes, too, that go along with this. The idea originally was that at some point in time, all of the coordinated care organizations would take over for the prepaid managed care health services organization, but there was a concern that that might not happen as quickly as you hoped. So this is set up so that the prepaid managed health services organizations can continue to operate until the CCO begins serving that area. And it just preserves the statutory criteria that apply to managed care organizations during this transitional period.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I understand your desire and appropriately to go through this line by line and get this through. This is going to take a long time tonight. I'm a little concerned that we've got people in the audience who have come potentially from some distances. Their testimony to me is actually quite important. We may see some dash fours before we're through here. I don't know how the committee feels, but I kind of like maybe take a time out here and take some testimony. Others may not feel that way.
Madam Chair, we could ask the other committee members to get comments to us, but also by...
Yeah, Madam Chair. Yeah. Madam Chair, we can go through the rest of the bill.
Yeah.
Maybe we should hear some public testimony.
Yes. Listen, I truly want to get to the county piece, and so that I feel that... I haven't gotten a whole lot of feedback, except we do want to change the interim to committee to legislative assembly, and I think Lori already has that. And
the
I
language from Senator Moore.
Yeah, and so Section 12 and Section 13. I don't think there's much controversy until we get to Section 14. And again, lines 13 and 14. And we've already talked about that. That on page 11. And again, that talks about the rights or benefits of Medicare beneficiaries. We already talked about that, so we need to have some language from some of the stakeholders regarding the rights. And then I don't think there was any controversy until
You're talking about controversy from anybody in the community, or?
Yeah.
What controversy you received?
That I received. Then I think
in addition to the Gang of Six?
In addition to the Gang of Six, okay. Yes.
Good. So the community is okay with everything?
Right. I want to get to section 22. I really believe that
page number.
I got to find it. Okay, a home care commission, page 19.
Madam Chair.
And I think we have to get onto the record why we said that. I think we've already said quite a bit of it already. But we took out, we changed language, and could you sort of start us on that page?
Madam Chair, real quick, just briefly, I wanted to just call your attention to the fact that we, as far as I can tell, we never had discussion about the antitrust language in the bill and what that means. We don't have to do it tonight, but okay. I want that flagged. What does that mean to providers? What does that mean to insurers? And the ramifications of that.
Thank you. Lori?
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee. The Dash 4 amendments removed Section 21, which was the section that authorizes the Home Care Commission to be the employer of record for collective bargaining purposes for these new categories of health care providers, the peer wellness, community health workers, and whoever the other one was. But they did retain on page 19 the requirement that the commission recruit, train, and certify community health workers and personal health navigators, and added that for any of those workers that were certified by the commission, that the CCOs would contract with the commission for their services.
For the record, I object to Section 20 altogether. I think it should be removed as well.
I think that with the co-chairs, we sort of compromised on this, and we wanted to keep the home care commission in. We will not mandate that a CCO use those providers, but those providers, if the CCO does use those providers, they have to come through the home care commission. There was one question that I had on page 20 in section 22. I thought lines 22, 23, and 24 were kept, and I just need Lori to explain that piece, because we wanted to make sure that if they were hiring, and like in Douglas County, there's over 600 home care commission providers, and it's probably pretty obvious that most CCOs will probably want to use those home care commission providers, but if they do, that they need to be under the umbrella of the home care commission with all of their salaries and benefits and that type of thing.
Madam Chair, healthcare transformation should not be an opportunity to grow unions, and that's what Section 20 does.
Lori, please.
Yeah, Madam Chair, the new language on page 19, 40A, 40B, and 40C, was intended to say that a coordinated care organization doesn't have to contract with the commission for these workers, only if they want to use the services of a worker who has been certified by the commission, then they would have to go through the commission.
Yes, Representative Freeman.
The discussion went something like, and correct me if I'm wrong, if the Home Care Commission trained and certified these workers. We didn't want to have CCOs hiring them outside of the organization that trained them and got them ready to work. But if a coordinated care organization wanted to put their own training together and develop their own workforce, we wanted to allow that flexibility. Is that close to what we talked about?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Freeman.
That's a deal breaker.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure that the way I read this, that that is the way it would be played out. Because we've identified categories of workers. We have the certification of those workers still in this bill. And you have the commission shall recruit, train, and certify community health workers and personal health navigators. That's a pretty all-inclusive statement. And I'm not sure that you've made the disconnect on a may permissive rather than a shall.
I think we did, Lori, didn't we? That was the intent.
The may's on line 48.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's why we added may on line 48, to say that they don't have to contract with the commission.
But the commission's the one that's certifying the people, so who in the world else are they going to contract with?
They don't have to hire certified people.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, I don't think it requires... I think it requires the commission to recruit, train, and certify, but I don't think that it limits it to that the people who can serve in that capacity only to those who are certified. It doesn't say in order to be a community health worker or personal health navigator, you have to be certified by the commission.
It doesn't yet, but that will come in rule at some point in time.
Well, that certainly isn't in our intent at this point in time, and well, that's how it is. Okay. And then I'm wondering on page 20 why we didn't keep in lines 22, 23, and 24.
Madam Chair, the idea was...
Now we've jumped to county governments, all right?
No.
I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
Never mind. That is in section 22. I forgot.
Okay.
Go ahead. Go ahead, Lori. We're going 21.
Okay. This is current law 414-153, and it specifies what prepaid health plans have to contract for with the counties. And there was some concern that some of these things, that it leaves out a lot of things that maybe counties could do better. And I think in other iterations, for example, if you look on page 21, lines 6 through 12, we had tried to mandate some more specific language. In the end, it was just, my understanding is that it was decided to just not try to be so specific about what they must contract with counties for, but instead allow the counties and the CCOs to figure out what the counties best provide and what works best for that particular CCO. So we've replaced all of section 22 with a new one, which starts on page 21, line 14B. We just took out all of that language and instead added what you find on 21A, beginning on line 14LL, and to the end of that page, which just says the authority shall encourage the advantageous use of system of public health.
And we forgot the words mental health authority and addictions and chemical dependency and... late in the night. I can't remember. Addictions, chemical dependency, and mental health.
Madam Chair, I think public health, it was at least the intent was that this is broad enough to encompass all of that, because then if you go to subsection 2, if a county within the service area of a coordinated care organization offers services that are cost-effective and meet quality measures established by the authority, the coordinated care organization may contract with the county to provide the services. So that's very broad.
Okay, well, I have heard from people that we did not mention mental health. They feel only public health services and not mental health services and chemical dependency services, and we did not mean to leave those out. And if our stakeholders out there feel that they need to be in, I'm just wondering if the committee is okay to add those.
Chemical dependency is now covered in the MCO, not in the MHO. It's only mental health services that are covered in the MHO, right?
We need language from the stakeholders. I just wanted to bring that to the group, and there will be language probably submitted by 5 o'clock tomorrow.
Yeah, Madam Chair, that language that on page 21A that's in 14KK through 14N, N is actually just current language. I just pulled down from the opening paragraph of 414.153. I mean, it really... It's just, again, sort of like whereas clauses encouraging the advantageous use of public health. So we could take it out and it wouldn't have any substantive effect if you thought that subsections 2 and subsection 3 were then broad enough to cover all of the services.
You could just say public health and mental health services in line 14MM, and I think it would solve what...
Or we can just have it tied to the global budget issue because of all of the funding streams, too, and I think it would be nice to get the Oregon Health Authority's input on this section.
Madam Chair, I think in some counties you still see some A&D services going through counties, so it does vary. So the language here is broad enough to encompass everything.
I think even in those counties, the MCOs have the substance abuse that it's services usually for non-MCO people, right?
But a lot, you know, substance abuse programs, drug courts, things like that go through the justice system, usually funnel through the counties. So,
not what we're talking about here. We're talking about
we're talking about
Oregon Health Plan money only.
And there's some of that there.
Mr. Goldberg, Dr. Goldberg.
Chairman Sanderson, members of the committee, we've been working on the funding streams, and I think can come forward to you with some language that really looks at certainly around mental health, the need to have CCOs be able to contract with counties for some of the safety net services. That at issue here is that there are many, many different funding streams that have Medicaid dollars attached to them. And those that are most easiest to identify are those right now that come through managed care. And those should be in the CCO. The next tier down are funding that supports Medicaid clients, but right now aren't necessarily paid for in the managed care environment. And we're looking at each and every one of those funding streams and coming up with a plan, and that's what will come forward in the global budget, for how to deal with those. Specifically around the county issue, we've been working very closely with counties to be certain that we continue to support the county mental health safety net and the critical safety net services, and have some language to assure that can happen.
Bruce, there's some direct funding that doesn't go through you that arrives there as well.
Correct. Well, and that's sort of the third tier is then the non-Medicaid general fund dollars, and that's not in any way contemplated in this bill.
But at some point, it will need to be.
That's exactly. And that's really how we've laid this out, is let's first start with the Medicaid dollars and tease those out so that it's appropriately funded. And then the last piece will be all the general fund, PEB, OEB, and the other kinds of
dollars. Federal funds.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Can you get them? Okay, so we will be looking for language to make sure that this is tied to the global budget piece to be submitted tomorrow. I assume that's in the best interest. And colleagues, the only other real controversial thing that I had heard is having the, I mean, there's still other issues that you stakeholders out there have submitted to us, but we will rely on you to identify these section by section, get them to Rick of the changes, because we're having our final amendment next Wednesday, maybe. But the other was having financial oversight of CCO should be done by DCBS, not OHA. OHA should not be able to set reserve levels as well. I don't know much about this, but this was a concern. So it said their solution was have DCBS do financial oversight and do not allow OHA to set reserve levels for CCOs. I just don't know enough to know whether that's a good thing or a bad thing.
I think if we intend to create insurance companies, then it should be DCBS. If we're just talking about essentially expanding the way an MCO works into a CCO, then it should stay with OHA. I don't think we're talking about insurance here.
Other comments? Yes, Senator Shields.
I think it would be confusing to the MCOs to have two regulatory bodies overseeing them.
Yes.
This is interesting. I think when it comes to outcomes and health delivery, Oregon Health Authority is the right place to measure that. When it comes to finances, I think DBCS is the right place to do it. So but also I'm sensitive to the fact that they're reporting to two different groups could be more burden on reporting. And I love the idea of another set of eyes looking at the book's financial portion of this to make sure it's solvent, other than the health authority. That's my two cents.
But reserves are based on the risk model, and that's a function that belongs with DCBS.
The insurance companies are regulated because they're taking premiums from individuals. OHA is essentially providing the money for this, and it's their responsibility to monitor that money. They can't. That responsibility can't go somewhere else. This is OHA. This is an OHA project, and you can't put another agency in the front of an OHA project. This isn't health insurance. This is a Medicaid experiment. This is a different way to produce Medicaid. And putting DCBS in it makes no sense whatsoever. I mean, there's no conceptual reason for doing it.
Makes total sense.
Thank you, committee.
And you and I agree once more.
Very much. I'd like to take the temperature. There are some people, Care Oregon, Bruce Bishop, OHSU, Denise Hansel, and Janet Carlson, I know, and then there's at least 10 other people, and I would like to know what the will of the committee is.
I think we should take testimony, those of us that can stay, hang in.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to say that I really don't have any other things to talk about through the rest of the bill. The other, I mean, if you wanted to just start taking public testimony, that the rest of the changes were just to allow for the managed care organizations to continue to exist in parallel with the CCOs.
And that's why I'm sorry, Lori. I should have said I feel that we have covered the most controversial things. We're going to get some more input by Thursday, tomorrow night. And then staff are going to get together and organize it for the co-chairs to take a look at. And hopefully we'll have another draft of amendments, because I think we've got a good flavor of where the controversial things are.
Senator Morse, will you be presenting that language that you think should go in?
I think OHA can also have language, because I think they've been talking together. Senator Morris.
I was asking if you were going to present the language that you think ought to be in that piece about OHA.
I think you've been talking with OHA about language for...
Medical liability.
And the question was, I was in the statute here.
Yeah. You can help present the language.
I was just asking if you were going to give the language.
Madam Chair?
Yes, I'm very open to hearing testimony, but it's really important that the testimony really
relate to the dash threes, and I know people have come to testify, many from far away, but what we need to know now is what you don't like about the dash threes. So if
what
we could,
you do like
or what you like about them, but
yes,
you know, but suggest the language, because that's where we're, that's where we are, and it's really important that we try to stick to that.
Okay, Representative Freeman.
I am happy to stay and listen to testimony for a fixed time. If you could, as chair, establish that time so I have an expectation, I'll be wonderful to stay as long
till
as
8:15.
You
could. 8:30.
8:05.
Okay, we're going to allow.
We'll take a vote.
I want Kara Oregon, Bruce Bishop, OHSU, Denise Hansel, and Janet Carlson. Please come forward and bring up. As the first panel, and we're going to allow you 3 minutes, and we have yes.
Give them the public hearing.
Okay, so with that, we're going to open an information a public hearing on HB 3650.
3 minutes.
3 minutes. Janet Carlson, welcome. Haven't seen you in a while.
Good evening, co-chairs, members of the committee. Janet Carlson, Marion County Commissioner, serving as the president of the Association of Oregon Counties this year. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify. I appreciate the conversation about counties and the interest in maintaining a county role. As you all well know, commissioners are the elected governing bodies of counties, and we have responsibility under ORS Chapter 430 to serve in the important role as the public health and the mental health authorities. We take that role very seriously. We deliver those safety net services that were discussed as a provider of last resort for those who are indigent.
What's that statute again?
Pardon?
The statute.
ORS Chapter 430. I don't have the specific statute, but my guess is that Cindy Becker and Claudia Black could provide it for you. We invest in Marion County about a little over $4 million a biennium. We're trying to verify the numbers, but counties overall invest roughly $40-plus million of county general fund into mental health services. We want to make sure that as you're talking about funding streams, that those funding streams are contemplated as well, and making sure that the system of supports for our fellow constituencies remain intact. We certainly support the integration of health care and mental health care. We certainly, as you want, an efficient and effective system, so do we. Our concerns are really about the county's continued responsibility and liability to provide services for our constituencies without the opportunity to be connected, if you will, to the system that you are all talking about. There is some alternative language to the language that was in the original bill that others from counties will be able to provide to you, and I hope that you take that under consideration. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
What is that language?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Denise Hansel, and I'm here tonight as the Executive Director of the Oregon Health Leadership Council. With me in the audience are also members of our board, including Greg Van Pelt, George Brown, Dave Ford, Joe Bryson, and others. So we wanted to be come here tonight in a group to support at transformation. You have some comments from us in front of you. We are actually working on the Dash 3 amendments right now, so we appreciate the extension to 5 o'clock tomorrow. So tonight we just want to briefly share with you our perspectives on health care transformation and House Bill House Bill 3650. First and foremost, the Oregon Health Leadership Council and its members are committed to transformation, and we know it is an imperative, and we are committed to do the work that's needed to do to make transformation effective. I think you all know the OHLC was created in the fall of 2008 at the request of the business community to implement actions that would reduce health care costs. We have launched several initiatives, and we have a lot of learnings from those initiatives. These are complex systems that need to be changed. You need commitment. You need trust. You need expertise. You need a willingness to learn and adapt, and you need time to implement these. These are all critical elements to long-term transformation. The council recognizes the significant cuts in the Medicaid reimbursement, and making these changes at the same time is going to be difficult for these organizations. But having said that, we believe strongly we need to move forward, and we're committed to doing that. We support starting with Medicaid as the first area of our emphasis, and believe a comprehensive and sound business plan to guide transformation is important. We need to look at every aspect of Medicaid, including the service delivery, transformation, benefits, eligibility, and payment models. And based on our experience of the collaborations and the other collaborations our members have partaken in, we need a well-structured process and adequate time to implement with the expertise and those who have ultimate accountability at the table. We are, as I mentioned, currently reviewing the Dash 3 amendments. We think they are a step in the right direction, but we do have some issues that we're going to bring to you tomorrow. We will be recommending a process to create the work plan and a timeline. I think we've recognized tonight this is a very complex change that is going to require thoughtful thinking and recommendations. We're also going to be proposing additional transparency and clarity in the global budget setting process and the risk mitigation provisions, clarification of the CCO reporting requirements and financial oversight, flexibility in the CCO design and governance. So appreciate the conversation tonight. We will be recommending some limited medical liability reform and clarity on the safe harbors, which we believe is really critical to do this work to remove those barriers so these organizations can work collectively. Again, we appreciate the extension till 5 o'clock tomorrow, and we'll be submitting those.
Perfect timing. Thank you. Thank you very much. And remember, focus, focus on the Dash 3s, and you did at the end.
Thank you to be here. I'd like to speak.
And say your name for the record.
I'm Dave Ford, for the record, CEO of Care Oregon. I'd like to amplify what Denise has been conveying. There's been a lot of work done by a lot of people, a lot of time involved. The word that really is operative is momentum. There's a lot of goodwill that's been started around transformation and dialogues that are rich and meaningful among hospitals, payers, mental health organizations that we have not had in terms of how to put these things together. A lot of the language and the work that you folks are doing is around kind of the technical pieces of how to put it together. I think what we would like to see is the work that's been contributed and the real thought in terms of how to make this work on the ground level in terms of putting organizations together that are going to make a difference for a lot of people. There are 215,000, I think, that we're talking about in the greater Portland area that we've seen data on. And what, dragging this out and not getting something done would be paralyzing. And so we really look to you to work through these things. I know after listening what a difficult process you folks are going through, but you've got really some optimistic people who would like to take this on. We know these are very, very difficult times, but there could be a lot of public harm in terms of access and other kinds of things if we can't get this together. You would be amazed by the dialogues of people coming together with goodwill, the mental health departments and the hospitals and the payers. So all I would say is, and I'll stop early, is the momentum that is gets built here and not dragging this out for iterative pieces so that we can go to work and get it done. The cuts are material. They are beyond what normal capability is here. We talk about 10 or 19% cuts. They are not rate trended for history. And so they really are understated. And so these are profound changes that we're trying to adapt to. And so our need is to have you allow us to keep the momentum of change and your support to make this happen with the budgets. Thank you.
Thank you. And Representative Freeman has a question.
And thank you for being here, Mr. Ford. And we had an opportunity last week to hear from CCOs about the transparency in the governance model. And I was very surprised by some of their responses. One of the things that we're very concerned about is making sure the monies we put out there are spent in the best ways to deliver the service. My question to you is, what do you think the transparency should be for that? How do we assure that, you know, monies given to CCOs are applied to providing patient services?
There now is a lot of accountability to that. We submit data to the department. We'll be the authority for that. That is not sufficient for what we need in the future. We really need to get down at a more complex level to see if we're actually causing some population effect. The triple aim framework really requires us to look at the whole population and improve the health of the population and the satisfaction of the population while lowering the cost. And those kinds of frames and metrics need to be put in place. There is going to be increasingly accountability and transparency among the providing partners and the paying partners, we think, because the dollars are going to be scarce and everybody's going to be accountable to be disciplined around providing effective care. There were a lot of comments around wasted care. There's no tolerance for wasted care anymore. We're going to have to root that out. Just because it's going to be necessary care and the right care, best available practice. So we think that there will be greater accountability in useful forms of data. And some of the things I've walked around today and sharing in terms of how you go about reaching people and dealing with this. And it cannot be done. The way it is now, it's so fragmented that people with mental health and complicated physical health aren't combined, and we lose a lot of synergy that can be had.
Representative Greenlight.
Thank you. Dave, I have a different question. I think you've had a chance to look at the Dash 3.
I have, not at the detail you folks are talking about.
But is it your impression that it generally goes in the right direction?
It is still tending. There's a lot of contradictory pieces. It doesn't feel from that there is the clarity. We do hope that by the time we get to the end of this process, we can see a way from those of us, whether it's a hospital or a mental health organization or a physician organization or a payer, can go together and we can move and get things going, because it's contradictory. There's some internal logics that we think are not sort of harmonious. So if we can actually say those folks that are ready to go, that can put things together and it meets the spirit of the law, can get together and get this thing going, it's an important capability we have to go through a vetting process through the interim and then an approval process in February. And by the time you get to putting this out and we actually have clarity a year from now, that's going to be complex for organizations that have to adjust to this limited resource.
And you'll point out those inconsistencies.
We will. We'll do it by tomorrow, by 5.
Thank you very much.
Next panel. And on deck will be Cindy Becker, Deborah Loy, and Joanne Fuller. With Claudia Bass.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Bruce Bishop. I am senior counsel for Northwest Permanente and for Permanente Dental Associates. You have a handout of our written comments, and I'm not going to go through them in detail in consideration of your time. I do want to point out that Kaiser Permanente is, in our view, the prototypical integrated coordinated healthcare system that you're trying to emulate. We have 60 years of experience of organizing and delivering care. We are a care delivery system, not a third-party intermediary. We have 470,000 voluntarily enrolled members in our medical care program and approximately 150,000 voluntarily enrolled members in our dental care program. I've identified 5 issues that we believe raise governance and operational concerns that you may want to consider. I know your committee, your staff, and your legal counsel can read and decide which of those issues warrant further attention. I do want to focus on three recommendations that we've made. The first is that you consider adding mental health services to the services that a physician care organization is eligible to provide to its Medicaid beneficiaries. That is not currently a covered service for a physician care organization like Kaiser Permanente, and we would like to have your consideration of expanding the scope of services that we can offer to our members. Second, we would like you to consider the possibility that a CCO could target a discrete population within the Medicaid population that might be dual eligibles, that might be kids. It might be some other targeted population that the provider organizations have expertise at addressing the needs of. We think that that would be a feasible step towards getting fully comprehensive coordinated care, and it may be an appropriate step to take that will also achieve some of the cost savings that you're seeking. Finally, we would ask that you consider a transitional provision that would give the same status to a physician care organization as is available in your Dash 3 amendments to a dental care organization, because we think it will be important to continue those arrangements during this transition phase. Overall, the Dash 3 amendments are a substantial improvement to the printed bill, and we support the direction that they're moving. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Bruce. Voice is you. Joanne and Claudia, come up too. Might as well. All right. Is she in? Oh, she's okay.
Great.
For the record, I'm Connie Seeley from OHSU. And in the spirit of what the chair asked us to do, I'm going to cut right to the chase and speak to the Dash 3s. What OHSU is asking for is we are eligible as a public entity to we are eligible to bring down certain funding streams such as IGTs, GME, DISH, and Title V funding. And our basic request is that those funding streams and mechanisms be put outside of the global payment. At the same time, I would say thank you that we are recognized in the legislative intent portion of the bill, but again, our ask of you would be to bring those funding streams outside the payment.
You said GMEs, Title V, and you said one other?
Disproportionate share.
I don't even know what that is. Okay.
Via the IGT, the Intergovernmental Transfer Mechanism. Sorry to introduce myself. Diana Gernhardt, the hospital CFO for OHSU.
Thank you. We have it noted, don't we, Brian? Yes, okay.
All right.
Thank you very much. Questions? Yes.
She looks a lot like somebody that used to work in Courtney's office.
No, she doesn't. She smiles more now.
That's true.
All right. Joanne Fuller, please. And Deborah Loy.
Cindy?
And Cindy Becker. Get three of you up here. Please proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Joanne Fuller. I'm the Chief Operating Officer of Multnomah County. And I'm here to just talk really briefly about a couple of issues. We, in the Dash 3 amendments, I recognize the committee's interest in trying to clarify the relationship between counties and the CCOs, and I think that the direction of specifying that services should be meeting the quality and funding requirements of the services of other providers that are going to be engaged in this effort is an important recognition, and I appreciate that. And I think counties in general support that. I think the thing that we are most concerned about is that in that language, it appears that it's a focus on direct service delivery, and in our conversations with both the Oregon Health Authority and other partners, we're really trying to help figure out how this bill can recognize counties' responsibility as a local mental health authority. that responsibility isn't about direct service. It's not about providing outpatient mental health treatment or drug and alcohol treatment. What it's really about is providing services in the crisis, delivering a crisis safety net of services for mental health care in the community. It's about working with the population of people who are committed to the state hospital, wind up going committed to local hospitals, and then wind up back out in the community again. It's about working with the residential treatment providers in the community to ensure that the quality of case coordination and care and delivery of services for residential treatment for seriously and persistently mentally ill in the community is delivered. And there's also a specific set of planning, case coordination, and community participation regulations that are attached to that local mental health authority responsibility. When the care, my assumption in Multnomah County is that we in the county will be a partner with many of the people you've heard from tonight in a coordinated care organization. But while we'll be involved in that partnership to deliver direct care for people under the Oregon Health Authority, we will still be responsible for the local mental health authority obligations ourselves individually as a county and the provision of care to the uninsured. And so we're just hoping that we can work on language with you that can recognize that responsibility and incorporate it, coordinate it with the coordinated care organizations. Thank you. Thank you, Julie.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for your testimony. Jenna Carlson suggested that the counties may bring us language to consider for this. This is a key area for many of us to look at, like we've had a discussion about tonight. And I'm still unclear about that language. And I would suggest if you could bring something to us. There's a lot of overlapping parts here. CCOs in the past have not been responsible for people outside of Medicaid who are mental health, as an example. That's a big risk for them to take on if that's included. We're talking about Medicaid only. What happens to the rest of your risk there? We lose that coordination. There's all kinds of issues here. And the language we've got, I think, is not really getting us where we want to be, including the idea that the CCO and the county do have to work together.
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, I think Cindy's going to talk about some specific language that we're ready to offer that I think will address the concerns that you have. We've been trying to balance our concerns as to create that county collaboration and connection with our understanding of the concerns that some of the other healthcare providers have about not wanting to have language in the bill that ties their hands too much because of the risk that they're taking. So I hope that you will consider the language that Cindy's going to talk about in a minute.
Good evening, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Cindy Becker, and I'm the Director of Health, Housing, and Human Services for Clackamas County. I hope what you have before you are two pieces of paper. One of them talks about the importance of the connection between the CCOs and counties, and the other one outlines the dual responsibilities that counties have. And that those charts in the white talks about the services, and counties, every county does services different. Some counties contract out all services, other counties provide all services, and most counties are somewhere in between. And the yellow part of this chart talks about the systems management, which every single county has a systems management responsibility as a local mental health authority. And that's really what we're talking about in terms of the importance of codifying something in this bill that really connects the CCOs with the counties. One of the things that Joanne mentioned earlier is the fact that as the local mental health authority, we are responsible for the safety net for everyone, regardless of whether or not they have insurance. So we build systems that not only integrate, make sure that we're connecting people at the service level, but we're connecting funding through Oregon OHP funding, state funding, and county funding. And so when we're looking at helping people stabilize in the community, we need to be able to have access to those dollars so that we can braid those dollars to stabilize people, to keep them out of jail, and to keep them out of inappropriately using emergency departments. And if we do not have that connection with the CCOs, that infrastructure, quite honestly, will collapse. You and I both know, we all know, that people on OHP and people who are uninsured are the same people. People go on and off OHP, and quite honestly, many of them are on it for the literally the luck of the draw, because they got the lottery that month.
And so we don't want to set up two systems for the insured and the uninsured. And we want to make sure that we have the capacity to serve the larger population. So in the written testimony that I provided, we do have language in Section 22. I'm not going to go over all of it, but I think that the first couple sentences are important. In recognition of the county's responsibilities as a local mental health authority, according to ORS Chapter 430, the Oregon Health Authority shall require written agreements between CCOs and counties where members reside, unless cause can be shown why such an agreement is not feasible based upon criteria set by OHA. These agreements shall include agreed upon outcomes and describe the authorization and payments necessary for the efficient and effective management of the following responsibilities of the local mental health authority or their designee with respect to member services. I think the important pieces here are we want to be transparent. We want to be held accountable. We don't want to buy. You know, we know some parts of the system are either waiting 2 years or getting out of the system. I kind of feel like the kid in the back of the classroom saying, pick me, pick me. We want to be involved. We want to have those contracts. We want to be involved with the outcomes, and we want to make sure that as a community, we are providing efficient and effective services. So the red light's on. I'll stop.
Thank you, Cindy. Deborah.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to speak
with
you.
Oh, yes, just a minute.
Yeah, I've been reading Section 430, as you suggested, and one of the main pieces of Section 430 is that the OHA needs to use money in this area in the most efficient way possible. And one of the issues of this is the integration of mental health services and money, or physical health services and money. It sounds like you're arguing to keep it separate from integration because you want it integrated with something else. You want the services and the money for OHP people integrated with the services and money for non-OHP people rather than integrating the mental health with the physical health for OHP people. Am I reading you correctly? And is what you're suggesting in aid of OHA using its resources most efficiently for mental health?
Chair Morris Anderson, Representative Greenlick, no, you're not reading me correctly. We're not asking for a carve-out.
Misstep.
We are wanting to make sure that in our partnerships, you know, that there is a recognition of the importance of continuing to build those systems. And, you know, with the global budgets, a CCO could say, well, you know, I'm just not prioritizing this group, or we're going to provide our own services over here, or we're not going to have those kind of connections. And we want to make sure there's something in statute that requires those connections. We're not asking for a carve-out.
By braiding, you mean, though, braiding OHP mental health dollars with mental health dollars for non-OHP. Is that what braiding means?
Yes, it's the OHP dollars, county dollars, and we get funding from the state, general fund dollars, to provide that safety net services for the population. So it's an access to those funds.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Deborah.
Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you and the committee. For the record, my name is Deborah Loy, and I'm the Government Programs Director for Capital Dental Care. We're the largest dental care organization in the Oregon Health Plan. We cover 180,000 plus lives in 18 counties. I am serving 18 counties, have about 400 independent practitioners that contract with us, 19 staff-affiliated clinics, and 12 federally qualified healthcare centers. And as I've gone around and talked to various medical plans try to begin those dialogues of what it would look like for a dental plan to be integrated, I've come away thinking it's with great wisdom that you're allowing the dental plans to have some transitionary period. And that is not intending that we are not advocates of transformation. We are. But I want to be able to do it within our delivery system in a way that I'm not going to lose any of the system that we've taken years to develop and the providers that we so very much rely on to deliver services to the population. And I'm not sure the Dash 3 amendment gets to the point of transition and the assurances in it that I think that the committee intended. I believe I've been told that there is some language that has been recommended by a peer for the Dash 3 amendment to be changed, but I'd like to just read some of the concerns that I have, and more so even just for my providers even. In some cases, there will be more than one CCO in a community. In some cases, my providers overlap, especially my community providers, more than one DCO, and I would hope in the spirit of community that we're able to get to the transformation of dental plans into the system with doing it without losing anything in that process or becoming a victim. So hopefully we can step into transformation and not step off the cliff.
And in your testimony, you did mention the language.
Yes. So that's what I would, the issues I have is making sure the there's not a disconnect between the Oregon Health Authority being under their directive with a contract and where we're going with the CCOs. I was not clear from the Dash 3 how the funding was going to take place or how membership was going to take place under the CCO. Since the membership goes to the CCO, yet their contract with the dental plan would be under the OHA. And I would hope, although the date says 2 years, that's not the target. That's not the target in my mind. The target is hopefully working as it makes sense in communities to really bring the best of dental delivery systems into the CCOs.
Thank you. And thank you for meeting me with me. A lot of you met with me regarding the concerns. Yes, Representative Freeman.
Thank you. And you say right at the end, the date's not the target, but if we don't put the date,
right,
everybody freaks out.
Right.
So how do you balance not having a date certain, so everybody waits to the last date to do something, and making people feel certain that they're going to be kept whole until they transform into the CCO?
I think as I've heard you discuss what the CCO's role is with others involved, I think if you bring your community together and you have this new entity that you're developing here, that hopefully dental can be brought into that in such a way that we feel we can make that transition without losing any of the current delivery system that we're trying to build on. So I view that, you know, if a CCO is working appropriately and rightly, we may not need to or want to wait for a 2-year time period. So that's not the target that I'm shooting for. And I also have an issue regarding having an either in or out for the dental plans. And the reason I do is I have providers that do business in more than one dental plan. And I don't want to add to the confusion or the administration that they already currently bear. So I would rather work together as dental plans to move towards the CCO together than to have my providers at risk for leaving the program.
You might try to give us a little language around that. All what you just said, it'll be hard to put that a lot more pages to get all that
okay.
in. I mean, do you understand what I'm asking for? I'm not trying to be too funny here, but somehow we have to figure out how we get it in words. I mean, I know you've written down what you've written here, but your words don't have an end date. Okay. Other stuff in the bill has an end date.
Okay.
Okay. All right.
Yes, real quick question.
Representative Kotek.
Thank you. Deborah, do you think it would be helpful if we, in direction from the health authority as we get applicants to be CCOs, that we somehow give extra points for those CCOs who have actually made the effort to reach out in a really constructive way to the DCOs to have them integrated? Because I'd rather have CCOs, as many of them out the door early with oral health included, with some appropriate sideboards. I guess, and you don't need to answer the question now, but I'd be curious to hear back from the community if that was an incentive, would that help to get to some of your concerns if we did it the right way?
I think if you do it the right way, and also if you do it with the you know, as I've talked to various entities who want to be CCOs, every single one of them wants to do it totally differently. You know, I want to do it this way, I want to do it that way, and I want to do it right with all of them, but I can't be there doing it right with all of them right from the front end. So I also think it'll depend on how this stages out for which communities are ready to go to CCOs first and the maturity of those communities. But, yeah, there should be. I want oral health in, too. I just want to make sure that we have oral health in such a way that I don't lose any of a very important delivery system that's very, very hard to replace.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks.
In the last panel, Rick Bennett, Art Towers, John Mullen, Paul Phillips. Dash threes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Rick Bennett, Director of Government Relations for AARP, Oregon. To the dash threes, very quickly. First of all, we certainly appreciate the language in Section 1 related to legislative intent, particularly 3B, health care services other than Medicaid-funded long-term care services are delivered through these CCOs and so forth. I don't think I have to go into the reasons why advocates for seniors and people with disabilities feel very strongly about that exclusion related to long-term care services. However, related to the actual definition of health care services in Section 17, Sub 8, we're concerned that there might be some conflict related to 8A, services required by federal law to be included in the state's medical assistance programs in order for the program to qualify for federal funds. I think that may be speaking to nursing facilities. And then J references provider services other than services described, several of the subsections, defined by federal law that may be included in the state's medical assistance program that may be referencing home and community-based services. So we'd like some clarification related to whether that indeed is in conflict with the intent of the legislation and long-term care services.
And that's all in Section 17?
17, okay. Sub 8. Mm-hmm. And then you've already mentioned the potential or the possible conflict related to the rights and benefits of Medicare beneficiaries and the opt-out to mandatory enrollment and opt-out provision. I can only say at this point that every single version of legislative concept and bill draft and so forth has been reviewed by our national people, and they have been very clear and strongly asserted the issue related to rights and benefits of Medicare beneficiaries. We've also been working with Dr. Goldberg and others related to the language for opting out. And so I have already communicated to our people this evening on this question. I hope to have information back tomorrow, and we'll share that with you and Dr. Goldberg and others to see if we can resolve this. Last, I would just say that medical liability isn't about doctors. It's not about attorneys. It's about consumers. It's about people who are injured by medical error. And when that happens, when they're harmed, they need to be adequately compensated and done so in a timely way. And so anything that you're concerning about related to medical liability needs to take, first and foremost, the perspective of consumers and people who are injured. And I'd be happy to work in the interim or any other time with others on that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. I'll be very brief, and we'll follow up with some comments in writing. I just want to say at the outset that this issue is really important to the people that we represent all around the state. This is about low-income people. So the first comment that I would have is about the governance issue. As tough as it might be to think about the governance involving consumers, people who are low-income, this is basically the program that people are being served by. So it's really very important. The ombudsman functions I'll comment on in writing. I just wanted to say a couple of things very quickly about some of the things that I don't think are really strongly reflected in this bill. And this, for these programs to work, the bill is largely silent on the role of DHS. The eligibility functions are still going to happen through the Department of Human Services. The coordination of services to make things work with wraparound services are absolutely essential to have the role of DHS, other community providers involved. Section 8 should include the right to appeal decisions about enrollment, disenrollment in a CCO or an MCO. And then Section 11 that has to do with the sharing of information, we're exploring and researching and looking into the issues that particularly affect the survivors of domestic violence. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Paul Phillips. This evening I'm representing managed care plans under Coho and Washington County. Specifically to the Dash 3 amendments, we believe there should be language including a timeline for public health benefit purchasers, and that would be Healthy Kids, PEB, and OEB within the CCO. So we incrementally moving forward. That is not in the bill. It should be. The second issue is the arbitration.
Right, PEB, OEB, and Healthy Kids?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Section 8, sub 3 of the bill with regard to arbitration you guys talked about. The language dealing with counties and hospitals to participate in the new CCO is very important. The discussion that we had wasn't about individual providers. It was about entities. And those entities could veto a process if they chose to, which would set back the process. And we don't want that. And no, that's not good for the recipients. It's not good for the system. There are issues around, and you had some discussion today with regard to community advisory committees and governance. For the record, committee members, we already have community advisory committees throughout federal and state and local governments, and they work. It's a prescriptive process that talks about who should participate in it. It doesn't get involved in the governance of an entity, which is generally a private sector, even though it contracts through public dollars and manages those public dollars. So it's very important you recognize that governance is an issue for the entity that takes on risk, no matter what it is. They should have the ability to make decisions because they have the liability, both financial and every other operative side. But the Community Advisory Committee is exceedingly important, so you bring transparency into the process and get people involved. We will have language for you, Madam Chair, that addresses that. Section 12 of the Dash 3 amendments talk about the global budget process. We believe that it needs to come back to the legislature in February of 2012. If for no other reason, it is a budget issue and it needs sign off by the legislature, but so does the definition of criteria for a CCO. Financial oversight, interesting discussion. For the record, most managed care plans already report to DCBS, and we also report to OHA. It's important that if you talk about risk and growing towards OEB and PEB and other programs, that you have a good analysis, and DCBS would clearly, without question, be a better agency equipped for that as part of the process. Be glad to debate that with you. Section 22, the counties have talked about it, but it's very important to Washington County. It addresses the safety net issues and how budgets actually work. So there's some real language that needs to be added there. I think the previous presenters did that, so I'll skip forward. There are other things that the draft three amendments seem very much prescriptive on how a CCO would have to be set up and what they would do. Some of the language should be a may, not a must. We'll have that cleanup for you. And there will be changes to the A and B and dental care organizations that I think were Scribner's errors when they were drafted. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Panel questions? Committee, thank you so much. I apologize for having this meeting go till 8:30. No, he's not. And so with that, I'll close the informational hearing and we're adjourned.